Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Every so often on our show, I like to step outside of the world of academia and interview individuals who are directly involved in the world of religion and faith, the practitioners, as I like to call them. It is my belief that these folks hold valuable knowledge and insights into our world that scholars frequently miss. That is what we have on the docket today. And actually, it is a topic that I have been wanting to feature since the beginning of our show some 8 years ago. For a long time now, I've often wondered what goes into constructing an actual church building. I've been known to sit in the pews on Sunday and wonder why some churches go with a movie theater-like feel to their sanctuary, whereas others prefer old-school pews, organs, and the like. Now, you might be wondering why I'm not listening to the sermon. Well, I'm just asking the questions nobody else is asking. It's my job, I guess. Well, today, we get some answers to those questions with my two guests, Dirk Dahlhauser and Carrie Jones, both employed by Goff Companies, a business entity that provides construction, design, real estate, and finance services to religious organizations seeking to put a physical footprint, i.e. a building, in their community. Mr. Dahlhauser is a project architect working at Goff Companies, having earned his bachelor's degree in environmental design at Texas A&M University and a master's in architecture at the University of Colorado. Go Buffs! He has accumulated over 22 years of experience working for various architectural firms. Carrie Jones, our other guest, graduated from the University of North Texas with a degree in finance and earned an MBA in corporate finance at the University of Dallas. Reverend Jones, as we should call him, is also an ordained minister in the Assemblies of God with over 20 years of experience as a church executive pastor, and he also heads up Healthy Church CFO, a limited liability corporation that provides financial and operational services to churches, freeing their clergy to do all that religious-y stuff, the stuff that they need to do and not worry about finances. Over at Goff Companies, he is a church planner and a client representative. We'll link to Goff Companies, Healthy Church CFO, and other fun tidbits over at our website, so stop by and check us out. Dirk and Carrie, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Dr. Gill.
On a few rare occasions, we've had multiple guests on our show, and this is one of them. So to help our listeners and me figure out who we're talking to, I'm going to have each of you identify yourself and say a few words about how long you've been in the business of building churches so that we can get a sense for whose voice belongs to whom. So let's start with Dirk. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. You know, like you said, Dr. Gill, I'm an architect. I've been working for a while, and I started in municipal projects. But about 10 years ago, I started working with Goff after I had an opportunity to do a church with one of my other firms.
And this is Carrie. I met Dirk when I was an executive pastor at a church in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It was right at the beginning of 2001, so about 18 years ago. And our church was relocating, and we hired Dirk as our project architect and Billy Goff, who owns Goff Companies, as our builder.
Tell us a little bit about Goff Companies, Billy Goff, and how did this company start up, and you know, why would anybody think of having a company that builds churches?
You know what? We really view at Goff Companies that this is a calling. Mm-hmm. It's you know, it's something that God has called us to do. Billy started out building commercial projects, you know, over 30 years ago, and built the first church in the late 1990s, and just seemed to be something that was appealing and had more of a long-term, I guess if you'd say it, an eternal consequence rather than just building an office building that is going to turn a profit for somebody.
I think also as a contractor, you are one of the last individuals that are brought to the table, traditionally. And if a project is poorly planned and gets to a point where it's permitted and a contractor is brought into price and the project's over budget, you know, the contractor kind of looks like the bad guy for bearing the bad news. So as a builder, Billy really felt like we needed to move farther upstream to help influence the church from our abilities and help keep a project aligned all the way through permitting so that there are no surprises at that point and you build a successful project.
So essentially you're a one-stop shop for all your church building needs.
From a planning and building side, but there are a lot of other entities that come into play to actually build a successful church or have a successful church. An example would be a strong audiovisual and lighting company, because worship centers are so dependent upon that technology today.
Okay, and you guys are located in the Dallas area?
Correct.
Okay, well, go Cowboys too, I guess.
Well, thank you.
And Rangers.
And Rangers. I'm a Seahawks fan, though, so, but you got a good quarterback down there.
Well, anyways, so do you.
Anyways, let's go ahead and build the church now. So let's say I want to build a church because my congregation's growing. Let me throw out a scenario here. We started as a Bible study group, grew to about 300 regular attendees, and think we're still going to be growing some more. We've been renting out a school gymnasium over the past year, but it's time for us to get underneath our own roof. I figure I'd just call you guys up with a picture of a cute New England church with a steeple and say, guys, can you get this thing up in a couple of weeks? And you all show up in a couple of weeks, we're sitting in pews, right? That's how it goes?
That's exactly how it goes.
Excellent.
we have this conversation with pastors all the time, and when we meet them, there is a certain expectation that things happen quicker than they actually do. But when we meet pastors, we say, Pastor, 1,000 days. 1,000 days from the day you say, let's go. By the time you plan it, by the time you get ready for a capital campaign, by the time you get through a capital campaign, by the time you align the campaign and the design, you get the documents done for permitting, and you can construct, it's 1,000 days.
So that's pretty fast. That's faster than some of the potholes outside of my house that don't get filled. So what is the first thing that does go on? So I'm a pastor, or maybe I'm sitting on a board of elders in our church, and we say, okay, it's time to start growing. What is the first thing that we should start thinking about?
Well, a lot of churches will immediately decide we need to hire an architect. You know, we've got to do something to provide for more people, and so let's go design a building. But there's a lot of things that a church has to give to an architect in order to design it, because an architect is only going to design what the customer tells him to design. And we have found that churches are really, really good at growing people. That's what we learn in seminary, how to grow people, how to grow congregations and deliver ministry. But we're not so good at growing facilities. And so we see lots of churches who don't really deliver ministry the way they want to, because they're forced into it by the design of their building. And if they could deliver ministry the way they wanted to, they would have to have a different component. So we say a church really needs to plan, and it involves a lot of things, but everything begins with the vision that God has given to the pastor for ministry and how that ministry is to be delivered. That's the beginning of everything, and from the beginning of the planning process until we move into the building, that has to take precedent. We also look at the demographics of the area, who is there and who is the church reaching. We look at growth trends and project them out to see what type of expandability we need, how they're using the existing facility. We have what we call the church's DNA, which is basically ratios, you know, number of attendees to seats, number of adults to children, number of attendants to parking spaces, that type of stuff. And all of that has to go into that initial planning. And we also think from the very beginning, the church has to have an idea of what it is willing to spend on the project and what an overall project's budgetary scope would be.
And what their willingness is to put towards the project. You know, we meet a lot of pastors, and we see a lot of what you could call disasters. We'll meet with the pastor initially, have a conversation, and inevitably he'll open up his closet door, and what we see there are a big roll of drawings that he may have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars for, and it's unrealized because somebody either didn't plan it properly or didn't count the costs along the way, and it just was never able to be built. That's really a disaster from the pastor's perspective, to have sold the project to the congregation and not being able to deliver that. So, you know, plans, designing plans that they can't afford, something that's out of balance, maybe they built too small initially or maybe too big, or what we see a lot is churches have gone out and they've purchased a piece of property already without really doing the rigor of analyzing that property, and the property just becomes too expensive to build on.
Yeah, I love a lot of those questions that you were asking, such as the ratio of people in the pews to parking spaces, the family structure. Is it older congregation with less kids or one with a lot of minivans and you're going to need a lot of youth group facilities, playgrounds, or whatever that might be? Because a lot of people don't think about that, right? And I'm one of these nuts and bolts person that does think about this. And so you guys, do you go around kind of asking for this data? I mean, I'm not sure that churches always have this data on hand. So is there some initial data gathering that goes on?
Yeah, exactly. So for us, it starts with understanding what the vision of the pastor is for growth. As an architect, Gary as an executive pastor, Billy as a builder, I mean, we have an idea, obviously, of what the parts and pieces of the church are. But stylistically, the focus, how they want to grow, through what ministry, that all comes from the pastor. So for us, it's really understanding his vision to grow, because we want to develop a strategy that realizes his vision. So for us, it's that initial planning piece is a data collection. So we have a list of items that we need to see, financials, attendance, parking counts, those kind of things. A big component of what we do is actually attend church. We attend Sunday services for every church we work with, because we're looking for traffic flow. We're looking for spaces that they use, how they use it, really about their facility, as much information that we can. And from that, we can formulate a strategy.
Are there any periods of time that you have to talk a pastor off the ledge, so to speak? Because I can see some people, if you know, my Bible study grew from, you know, a couple dozen families to, you know, 300, now we're at 600. I think we're going to basically missionize the entire Pacific Northwest in a matter of a year, right? So we need a building that seats 50,000. I can imagine you need to scale some expectations appropriately.
Almost every project we have that.
That's the great thing about pastors.
But, you know, every pastor that we work with is a person of faith. Mm-hmm. And but faith is huge. And we work with some pastors who really want to build, and we can tell from the very beginning that they want to build more than what their financial capacity is going to align to. And so, yeah, we have to temper that and show how something can actually be realized. And that goes back to what Dirk said a minute ago about that pastor that has a roll of plans in his closet that he had paid for to have drawn and never realized it.
But that's okay. To have that vision is okay. To me, when I hear that's a master plan. And so you want to develop the master plan, but you want to have a strategy to get there in small steps. Small steps that you can handle and you can afford to get there. So, you know, that vision doesn't scare us. We think that's great.
One of the things, even before you get to the point of the size of the church, and I want to talk about that in a second, it's the issue of location, because real estate is location, location, location. Are there any things to consider there that you help out congregations with?
Yeah, I think that is so important. Visibility is important. That drive-by appeal is very important. But I think what's more important about the site is that it's buildable. We meet pastors that have already gone to that point where they've purchased a site. They may have purchased 20 or 30 acres. They've walked out there. They stand in the middle of it. They look around. It's flat. It looks buildable. But they didn't really go through the rigor to analyze things that may be below the surface. They may not have understood the utility connections. I've walked on sites that are beautiful, but, come to realize that there's no utility infrastructure. And you may have to go a mile or 2 miles to bring water, sanitary sewer, and you may be into a project for $2 million before you can even turn a shovel. So we just think it's really important. If you're going to go out and buy a piece of property, go ahead and engage an individual that can kind of go through the rigor and truly assess the ability of that site to perform how you need it to perform.
One of the things that I've done in some of my research has been to look at zoning laws and government regulations. And sometimes we don't think about that very often. And a church says, well, here's a beautiful location. We'll plop down right there. It's by a neighborhood. But then all of a sudden the neighbors are, raising their pitchforks and torches saying, wait, you can't build here because the parking lot lights or something like that. Are there problems that you encounter like that?
Yeah, we do. We're here in Texas, so it's very church friendly. We have a church almost on every corner, but we do work in municipalities. We have a project up in Philadelphia, and we have a project outside Boston. They're less church friendly. The project outside Boston, we're expanding. The initial phase was done by another architect and another builder. But the style of the church was dictated by the municipality and was actually dictated by their lending institution, because the lending institution, in the event that they failed, wanted to make sure that they could sell that building. In Philadelphia, we've been working with this church to get a 50-car parking lot approved for the last year and a half. Those are just obstacles. That'll kill the desire to expand a facility. So it's unfortunate, but we do see those.
Also, some municipalities tend to put a lot of cost into just the development of a land, and that's probably true for churches and for commercial entities as well. But I know a project we're working with in California, in the first phase, half of the construction cost is underground. Just getting the utilities and the water displacement handled. So,
yeah, if you're the first in to build on the site, the municipalities will treat you like a developer, and they'll require you to develop the infrastructure outside your property lines. So you don't get a free pass from many municipalities. And the thing is, Dr. Gill, you just have to understand that you have those costs. If you understand the costs that are in front of you, you have a much better opportunity to plan the project well and get a successful project. If the development costs are too much, you move to another site. But it's hard to do once you've already purchased 20 or 30 acres.
That must be a difficult process, too, because I know that the location of the church can actually have a huge impact on who is going to come. I know this because if it snows here a half an inch in our area, nobody goes to church because it's too dangerous. So it's just a tiny little cost. But if you move a church 4 or 5 miles down the road, it doesn't seem like that big a deal. But there will be people that say, it's just a little bit too hard to get up on a Sunday morning to make that extra 10, 15-minute drive, especially if you got to get a bunch of kids into the van and stuff like that. So it must be difficult to balance where your congregation is, where they're coming from, along with the building site, right?
Well, one of the things that we do in our planning piece is we do a demographic study. We also analyze the church roles, and we plot their addresses. So we can quickly see where those members of that church are coming from. And we look at it for another, for two reasons, really. Is this church just a small neighborhood kind of community church, or do they have a regional influence? Or are there natural barriers that don't allow the church to reach a certain segment of their community? It could be a river, it could be a large lake like we have here in Texas, those kind of things. So it's important to know where your church is coming from. And a lot of churches today, they're not expanding, they're not growing larger on their site. They're doing satellite venues. So understanding, you know, planting that satellite venue in an area where you already have a base that can attend that church is critical.
Because churches are unique in the fact that most of the churches we work with are trying to reach new people, unchurched people, and so they're actually building a facility for people who aren't here yet, and putting it in a location that is going to attract those people who may not even know the church exists yet is kind of tricky.
Yeah, and yeah, as you mentioned, a lake or a river, it these costs seem so minor for people, but they do have a huge impact on whether people will make the extra 10-minute drive in or not. So,
we work with a lot of churches that are kind of in rural Texas, so mm-hmm. it's very common for a family to drive into town on a Saturday night, spend the night in town and attend church, and then head home. So people will, depending on where they live and what they're used to, they will make that effort. But most people, there's about a 15-minute, 20-minute kind of area of influence. You know, once you leave your house, they'd like to be sitting in church in the worship center within about 15 or, you know, 20 minutes.
Yeah, and that actually fits with my own personal experience, too. We were at a church that took about a half an hour, and we were eventually saying, we got to do something a little bit closer. And 10 minutes doesn't seem much to serve God, I guess, but I guess it did. And you said that some people drive in on Saturday, spend the night. Do they do this in RVs or hotels or what?
They'll stay in a hotel or a family member in town.
Okay. Because that'd be kind of cool, just like an SEC football game, you know, people tailgating and coming in. That would be so fun.
Well, they have to come into town to do their shopping.
Yeah.
So they'll do that on Saturday, spend the night, and then go to attend church and then head home the next day.
Let me ask you this question. For the typical project that you do, how big is the church in terms of members? I'm sure there's a wide variation. Actually, give us the variation and give us the average.
We have buildings with worship facilities that have as few as 300, and we have built worship facilities with 5,000 seats. So it's a wide range. That size is coming down a little bit. You know, the days of the 5 and 10,000 seat worship bird, well, there's not that many of them because of the multi-site movement. But when we work with the church, couple of things. One, we always emphasize that there has to be an expansion strategy. Some churches will go to now that are in an existing building that cannot be expanded because of the way that it was originally designed, either in the location of the buildings surrounding it, or just the worship room itself is not expandable because of the construction methods. And so we always recommend that a church build with an expansion strategy in mind. And the second thing is very few churches right now economically can afford to build a building that's big enough for everybody to come into at one time. And so multiple services are a reality for most churches. And it does several things. One, it gives congregants options about service times, but it also allows for the building to double its capacity, basically.
Yeah, that's something that I wanted to ask about, and it's interesting because I know that multiple service times are often what pushes churches to want to expand physically because the pastor just can't do five services on Sunday and then maybe even two on Saturday as well for such a growing organization. You know, two or three maybe would be possible, especially if you have a pastor, a co-pastor willing to rotate on that kind of stuff. But that stuff becomes important. I want to get into the actual physical building aspect of it. And you mentioned that sometimes you're building sanctuaries that can't expand. So you got to really think about the physical space here. And give us an idea of what are some of the things that I should be worried about as a pastor of, let's say, one of your average sized projects, maybe, I don't know, 400, 500, 600 people. What should I be thinking about going into the actual building?
Well, I think it's building the correct components that align with your ministry and building the right amount of space. So churches, kind of the big rock components of the church, is the worship center. The worship center is comprised of the seating area, the platform, and the back of house that support the platform. There's also an ABL component because they're driven by that. Many churches are, and so there's support for the audiovisual and lighting component. There's a commons, what we call a commons. The days of a small entry vestibules are gone. The days of fellowship halls are gone. We haven't done a fellowship hall in many, many years. That space is now what we call a commons. And then there's the education component. The commons we see in size to be about the same as the seating area within the worship center. And that's the node of all the information. You know, when you walk into the commons, it's large, it's open, there's soft seating, there's monitors, there's a coffee shop. The education component is really focused on children and not so much as adults. It's really kind of young family, children focused.
I'm glad you said coffee shop. That's one of the best things we have up here in Seattle, is you get people in with the lattes and things like that.
You have some good ones. Now, one of the things that we really emphasize when we're helping a church plan is this concept of balance, a balanced facility. So if you have more seats in the worship room than you have parking spaces, you can't fill up the worship room. Or if you don't have enough children's space, you can't fill up the other areas of the building. A church that I was with here in the Dallas area, we had a very large worship center. It would seat several thousand people. And we'd fill it up three or four times a year on special occasions, but week after week, we couldn't fill up the worship room. And we realized we didn't think we had enough children's space, so we bought a building next to us, remodeled it into children's space, and everything in the church then began to grow as soon as we opened it, including worshipers in the worship room, until that building got filled, and then everything stopped again. So we figured out this idea that it doesn't do any good to have too many seats in the worship room if you can't fill it up. It would be better to use that space in different areas, either children's education or, depending on the ministry model, maybe adult education, and certainly you have to have enough parking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, parking becomes really important. I want to talk about that in a second, but the issue, I mean, you just brought something up, is that if it starts to get too crowded, people stop coming. And again, it's one of those little things you'd think, well, that's not a big deal, but it does make a difference at the margin there. And again, if it's too big, I mean, I've been in churches like this that have huge sanctuaries, worship centers, and it feels like it's only a quarter filled up, and you feel like the church is actually dying, right?
We call that uncomfortably empty.
Yeah. And so finding that balance is interesting. Another issue that comes up, and I'm wondering how much this goes into the thought process, is the use of the space not on Sunday. I mean, that's obviously the time everybody tends to focus on, but there's then Monday through Saturday. Can this building be used for other things? Obviously, Bible studies, small groups, different things like that. But what about possibilities of renting things out to a community, maybe putting in a basketball court that could
be
used for...
That's definitely a trend that we're seeing. I'm just saying that, you know, some of the trends that we're seeing in terms of space is that the... that a church finds it difficult to build large facilities, and the trend is that they're building less adult education space, more children's education space, but that commons is getting bigger, and a lot of things are happening in that commons. And churches, you're absolutely right, churches want to bring the community into their facility during the week. So, you know, the coffee shop that's open on Sunday for the congregants is also open during the week. There's Wi-Fi capability, there are table chairs that are found in the commons, so people can have business meetings there. But anything that kind of drives the service to the community, churches are gravitating towards. There are families out there that are looking for places to have, for example, children's birthday parties. So we see indoor play areas, play structures like you would see at McDonald's, as an element of the children's space that's used during the week. So anything that they can do to draw families into the facility and make it multi-purpose and open to the congregation during the week is beneficial.
I can imagine that's a huge component of the mission, too, because you have your church building for your members, but they say, hey, we're open to the rest of the community. Come in, check us out. You can use us for a, you know, daycare center or a, you know, mom and me group or something. And if you decide to stay for the, you know, Sunday services, all the better.
Absolutely. Churches have figured out it's a lot easier to get people back once you've had them in your building the first time.
Yeah. What about parking? You mentioned that before. Has that become an issue? I can imagine that there's big differences between, you talked about Philadelphia before. I'm sure there's a huge parking nightmare there as compared to, you know, rural Texas where you just stop your car and you're parked.
Well, parking is interesting. Parking takes up a lot of land. Parking demand is really a component of how you do ministry. So many churches that we see today are doing kind of a one-hour model where they're bringing everybody on campus for an hour, and there's an exchange the second hour. They're identical hours. Parking demand is driven by how you do ministry. So we see many churches that may have an early Sunday morning service, and then they have a education hour, and then they have a third hour, which is the later service. That middle hour, because you have people that are coming out of the first service going to Sunday school or education, you have people coming in onto site for that middle hour of education that then roll into the second hour of worship. That's a huge demand for parking. Municipalities typically will have parking ordinances, and they're typically, you know, one space for every four seats or one space for every three seats. That is just not enough. If you have a lot of people, if you have education going on at the same time you have worship, that demand could be almost a one-to-one ratio, one car to one seat. And so your ministry model has a huge effect on how much parking you have to provide, which also has a direct correlation about how much land area you need. For every 100 seats or so, you're going to need an acre of land just to park those seats. So there's definitely a direct correlation. So how you do ministry, how you structure your Sunday morning, has a big effect on the size of the facility and the demand for parking.
What about the pastor's house, or sometimes they call the parsonage? A lot of times the pastor will live on site, other times they live off site. And that oftentimes has big tax implications. Here in Washington State, I've looked at the rules, and there's this, if the pastor's house is on the actual church property, it can be tax exempt. But if it starts to move off, then it becomes a big issue of what really constitutes the church property and tax exemption and all that stuff. So have you dealt with any of those issues before?
We don't really see a lot of parsonages, churches providing the actual physical a residence for a pastor. It does happen, and we see it some, but we don't see very many of those being built. The tax implications now for churches allow the church or allow the pastor to designate a portion of his salary as a housing allowance, and then the church so designates it, and then that becomes a non-taxable income to the pastor, and then he provides his own housing. So that's the way it's generally held.
Let me ask about issues of taxation, also finance too, because this is going to have a big impact on how things are going to be structured. Carrie, you do a lot of this financial planning for congregations. What impact does the tax implications and their financial flow have on what can be built and where it can be built?
Well, it has a great deal of implications, and you wrote a great article about municipalities and how they treat churches. You know, churches are typically exempt from property taxes, state property taxes. So if a church purchases a piece of a property that is in a business district or a commercial district that would have had a for-profit entity on it that paid taxes to the municipality, and now a church comes in and buys it and does not have to pay those taxes, it affects the municipality's ability to raise money. So they are sometimes hesitant or even anti a church buying a piece of property that is desirable for a for-profit entity. So the churches sometimes have to face that. The difference is that churches typically, especially growing churches, will put a lot of money into the local community on its own with assistance programs and educational programs for the community. So where they're not paying taxes, they are giving back to the community.
Yeah, I'm sure that has to be a big part of selling the zoning committee or the zoning bureau what you're going to be doing with the church there.
That's right. But churches also provide other economic impact, too. You know, a church that has services on Saturday night, on Sunday, is going to bring people in and get them out of the house and spending money in the community. So those things just have to be communicated to the municipality to give them a basis of reference to see that they, even though they won't be receiving a tax base, they are receiving some economic benefit.
I want to move on a little bit to the style of building. We've talked about the things that you need, the commons area, the worship center, play area for kids and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure plumbing and all that stuff affects it. But even with those things that you do, there's going to be some diversity of what the actual church would look like. Give us a sense of the different denominations that you've built for, and if there's any tendency to, you know, certain types of denominations like the old New England style of steeple and other, maybe, I don't know, Pentecostal ones like big warehouses. Do you sense any trends like that?
I think we're seeing a trend towards churches that are not as churchy. You know, they're more black box theater type that have a heavy emphasis on ABL. But at the end of the day, Dr. Gill, it's really about the preference of the church. We're working with a church down south, north of Houston, and, you know, they're very, very traditional. And even though they're moving and relocating to another piece of property, they still want to keep that traditional aspect of their style. And they're just doing it in a more contemporary way. But we are seeing churches that have less symbology to them, because I think churches are trying to reach those that are unchurched or dechurched, and they want to make their facilities less intimidating and more welcoming.
That's interesting to me, because I have the ideal image of the New England church steeple, kind of cute congregation with the narrow stained glass windows in it. I just think that just, for me, that kind of rings out churchiness. But I've been in some of these, you know, box types churches, and they work really fine for everything. Again, what do you build for Catholics? Do you build for, you know, Protestants? Who do you all build for, actually?
I think we've done one Catholic church, but all our other churches have all been Protestant denominations.
What also about the seating arrangement. Some churches, I was in one church where it was largely a big gymnasium, and they used that for the community to play basketball during the week and things like that. And you had the, you know, bring out the folding chairs and that before the services and clean them up afterwards. Other places have more stadium seating, some have balconies, some have cry rooms. How does that factor into the building process, and are there some churches that like some things versus others?
Yeah, when we see, you know, we've seen the churches, we've built churches that have built the initial gymnasium, and they use that as a worship center with the idea of kind of building their base and building a worship center expansion later on. But what we're seeing is a configuration of a room that is more fan-shaped and less, you know, traditionally rectangular. Pastors, they want to make a connection to the congregation, so it's difficult for a pastor to preach to that person at the back of the room. It's also for the congregants, because if you put them in an arc format, it feels more like a family, you know, when you can see each other, when you can sing and you can hear each other sing. So, the rooms are getting smaller. The days of the 5,000, the 2,500 seats are kind of few and far between, but there is an ideal distance from the platform to the back of the wall, which is about 90 feet. Anything really kind of beyond that, you start to get into stadium seating to get the capacity of the rooms up.
Yeah, that's 90 feet. Is there anything magical about that number? I've always thought about that.
I think it's visual. I think it's the speaker's ability to communicate to that distance.
Mm-hmm. Are there any different styles between your urban, suburban, and rural churches? Do you sense rural churches want some maybe more traditional style, suburban churches trying to get the young families who are unchurched into more hip and stuff? What do you sense any trends there?
Yeah, absolutely. There are differences, and rural communities do seem to be a little bit more traditional. You know, what we have found is that churches are no longer wanting to, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, babysit Christians. You know, and they're being built to attract the unchurched. And the old traditional style churches would be sometimes intimidating to people who weren't familiar with church. So we're seeing churches really being designed that look more like a movie theater or a commercial building or something, and they might have a steeple or a cross or something on it that designates it as a church, but it looks less intimidating for somebody who has never been to church to come in, because that's the real target.
Do you ever work with the congregation, give them ideas about their natural surroundings? Out here in the Pacific Northwest, we sometimes get great views of the Cascade Mountains, or there'll be a nice forest behind things, and you go in there and say, hey, you should really open up your worship center a little bit more, put in some more windows here, because it really kind of gives you that natural feel. Or alternatively, close up the windows, because all the congregants will be watching squirrels instead of listening to the pastor.
Yeah, we take that into account in, you know, every site. We worked with a church in Las Cruces, New Mexico, just finished it up, that we opened their commons area with a lot of glass so that there was a view of the mountain range. Yeah. It was just very close to them. Another one that here in the Dallas area that had a big vista that they were on top of that they could see across. A church we worked with in Arkansas, in fact, had a full glass wall behind the platform because it overlooked a forest range. But yes, every church we would want to take advantage of the natural beauty of any site.
But we see them trying to capture that view from the commons area and not so much from the worship center, only because the rooms are so driven by the AVL. So the more light you put into the worship center, it competes with the projectors that are projecting images. You need much power, more powerful projectors, which are more costly. So we see the views, from the commons areas.
Let me ask a little bit about that AVO then, and that makes sense too. You want to have less light coming in because otherwise it diffuses and you don't get to do the projectors and stuff like that. But the projectors and the acoustics, are more and more churches going to the modern PowerPoint laser light show kind of thing? I've had experience with that and I love it at times, and there are other times that I just like a very simple choir, you know, a kid's choir or some adult singing and more subdued. How does that affect the building, and have you seen any trends there?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing a shift towards the theatrical. A couple of things here. With the AVL packages, what they're trying to do is they're trying to create an immersive environment. So we see a trend to house lighting that is dimmable and that is actually color changing, so you can create different moods within the seating area. We don't see any laser lights per se, but we do see lights that are controlled by the AVL booth, so they have some movement to them. We are seeing there was a time where rear projection was in fad because you could get a bright image. Projectors have become more powerful to compete against the natural light or the theatrical light. But the trend now today is really toward LED walls. So they are smaller LED panels that are put together in a series of rows and columns, and can create a big wall of imagery. We're also seeing a trend toward what's called environmental projection, so the ability to cast a large image on the entire front wall. So we are definitely seeing a trend to that, and less to a kind of fully robed, large, 100-person traditional choir.
How easy is it to remodel some of this stuff? Because I can imagine the rear projection stuff requires certain space behind the platform that's going to be wider than your typical front projection. And so your church, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago says, we're doing that back projection because this is the wave of the future. And then 3 years later say, oh no, you can't get those anymore because they're so out of fashion. Do you think about ways to remodel this as technology changes?
Sure. The churches that have rear projection, they've long ago converted to front projectors, so they've already kind of done away with that. But again, that's a space that can be captured for something else. Rear projection typically is a back of house function, and it's at a second level, so it becomes a little problematic to repurpose it into something other than maybe storage or a production suite for AVL.
Have you ever had to talk folks out of some kind of aspect of the building that just seems a little bit too crazy or wacky? And I bring this up because there's a church by us that has a baptismal center that's got cliffs and a waterfall, and it just seems, it's really neat. At one point in time, you looking and saying, wow, this is really cool. I want to get baptized there. But on the other hand, you're like, oh, this space could be used for something else, and it just seems really over the top.
Maybe in the children's side, we've seen some. What's popular today is in the children's area is a themed children's area. So we've seen some theming for kids areas that may be a little bit over the top. But from an adult's perspective, but the children seem to love it.
Yeah, I also wonder if, we're going to do a Star Wars thing, and then 10 years from now, kids are like, what's Star Wars?
Yes, I think you're right on point. I think you have to be careful because it can get kind of trendy. Mm-hmm. So we know that theming is important in children's areas, so what we try to push is a more timeless approach to theming. So it may just be more shape-driven, interesting shapes with interesting colors, because at the end of the day, you can always repaint.
It is interesting that you brought up the baptistry, because that is kind of a trend of putting the baptistry, taking it out of the worship room and putting it into a commons area, and then have cameras that would be able to allow it to be shown in the worship room. But we see that quite a bit.
It's an amenity. It's an amenity right. to the commons because it ends up being a water feature during the week, and it offers that kind of background, kind of white noise in the commons. That's actually quite soothing.
Mm. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I've thought about that too. I've seen some baptismal areas that are really complicated, and you have to think about the plumbing for these things. But also I've been to cowboy churches where they say, you come on over to the horse trough and we're dipping you in, which I think is cool. I was like the coolest baptisms I've ever seen. Interesting and stuff like that. Let me ask you about some projects that you have done. What have been some of your favorite projects and why were they your favorites?
Oh, I think our favorite projects are those with the biggest challenges. One that really kind of comes to mind is a church that we did not too far here from our office, but the church was a very dynamic pastor. They were squeezing so many people into the facility, and people were willing to put up with it just because of, you know, the message that was being preached. And the church realized they had to grow. They couldn't grow in the area that they were in because they were limited by a neighborhood, so they purchased some 170 acres. But they just couldn't figure out how to get out to that project. The building committee was smart enough to seek wise counsel. They hired a civil engineer. The civil engineer went out and did an estimate and calculated it would probably take about $2 million to get that site ready for development. We met the pastor, we heard that story, and we did a planning assessment for them. And yes, there was some cost to get the site ready, but we got that down to less than $300,000 through some negotiations with the city. And once we were able to do that, we just really, the pastor could see the light at the end of the tunnel, and that vision opened up, and it was much easier for them to get out to that site. So those kind of things. You know, helping that church who is struggling to get that first step, and allowing them to make that first step, and then building that project. Those are the ones that I think are most enjoyable and are successful on our end.
Carrie, how about you? You have any special
projects? One of my favorite projects is a church we work with over in the Fort Worth area, who came to us, and they were in a very small worship room, very small facility. It seated 200 or less. And they knew they needed to move. They were packed up. I think they were doing 5 services a weekend at the time, and asked us to help them figure that out. And they just didn't have the financial capacity to do anything. So we walked them through the process of buying a piece of property, getting it paid for, and it took about 5 years. For them, or 4 years, I guess, to be able to walk through that. And then once they got it, we were able to show them how they could build a facility that was expandable, but one that they could afford just to get out onto the property. And now they're on that property and experiencing tremendous growth. And we're about to go into an expansion for a larger worship room for them. And just to be able to see the pastor's vision come to pass through that, and having to take small steps, and then you can take bigger steps as you move along, and being able to guide them through that. You know, a lot of times when we go into churches that we plan, a church will come to us and say, okay, I want to build this new worship room, and it's so many seats. And oftentimes we'll say, you know, that's a great master plan, but we recommend that you don't do that right now, that you do something less, which is kind of odd for a contractor to tell them you don't need to build as much right now. But we want to help churches stay healthy, and that's what that church has been able to do.
Yeah, again, planning that not too big, not too small. You got to hit that Goldilocks center, I think, in a lot of these. A few years back, we had Jeremy Lott on our show, and he talked about the list of weirdest or ugliest churches that came out. And some of these things were, they look like UFOs or like chicken coops, or there's a lot of things. We'll link back to that that podcast. Have you experienced any, what was the most unusual thing that you experienced in the building process?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't know if we've really had too many unusual. We've had pastors come to us who have wanted to buy a theater, for example, and those style of theaters where they had the sloped floor and he wanted to build all that up and make it flat. There were some challenges. So, there's some odd things that have come across our desk in that way, but I don't really know of any other.
I can't think of any.
We've never built the spaceship.
Okay, so you're not responsible for any of the list of the 10 ugliest churches in the world or anything like that. So that's good.
I've helped churches that were in a geodesic dome move into something that actually was a little more timeless.
Yeah, I know. I remember the 70s, the geodesic dome movement.
Yeah.
And actually, Amazon.com out here is actually bringing that back to their headquarters in Seattle. So I don't know. Maybe it was the wave of the future, and we just weren't ready for it in the 70s. But who
maybe
knows?
So.
Let me go ahead and, well, actually, one more question before I do my last question. Do you folks ever do follow-up visits to some of your churches? I'm sure you go, the first week or two after they have their grand opening. But, do you ever go 2 or 3, 4 years later and say, I wonder how these folks are doing, if we really met their needs and if they need anything else?
Yes, that's something that we think is very important because, in the church world, it's very relational. And that's where we really want to connect with a pastor. There have been, not just with churches, but with individual pastors who have gone on from one church where we worked on to another church. Maybe they were on a staff at one, and now they're a senior pastor somewhere else, and we will engage with them to help another church. But, yeah, projects that we finish, usually 6 months after they finish, we do a follow-up, and then stay in touch at least on an annual basis and see if our projection, how our projections from the very beginning matched what we thought it would do after they moved in. Because that really changes between churches. Some churches will move to a new facility and they'll experience a 40 or 50% increase in attendance their first year, and some churches will experience a 10 or 15% increase. And it's interesting to see which ones how that turns out.
Yeah, I can imagine it's a learning process, not only for the congregation, but for you, and you make adjustments over time as you discover things.
It is.
And that brings me to my last question. You've both been in this industry for some time now. The question I always love to ask my guests is, what have they learned over the course of their professional experience? If you had the chance to go back 20 years and talk to young Dirk or to young Carrie, what lessons would you tell them about, or would you tell them that there's going to be some surprises along the way that you're not expecting, and here's what they are?
For me, I've, over the last 10 years of doing detailed planning and just church analysis, really drilling deeper, I'd love to take that same information. I remember in college, this was a little longer than 20 years ago, of doing a church project, and just surprised how little I knew of church and the dynamics of it. I would have liked to have taken all the information I have now and had that opportunity to apply that knowledge, because if I had been able to do that, I would have been coming out of college with a lot of information. I could have probably helped many more churches.
Carrie?
Yeah, I think for me, I would tell young Carrie that everything that you're doing is leading toward something else that's bigger. I believe what I do is a ministry call. When I was an executive pastor, I was helping to lead and preach to a very large congregation. But I feel like what we do now is able to impact not just a single congregation, but many, many congregations across the country. And as much of a call to ministry as what I did on the staff of a local church.
Some very, very cool lessons. My guests today have been Dirk Dahlhauser and Carrie Jones of Goff Companies. Gentlemen, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Dr. Gill.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.